This is day three of this January 2013 Rohatsu seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from previously. This is a book with the teachings of 16th century Chinese Zen master Zibo. And the book is called Zibo, The Last Great Zen Master of China, translated by J.C. Cleary. Here the translator gives this entry the title, Truth is Indescribable. The Dharma is indescribable. If it could be described, the Dharma too would be a description. The sages know that the Dharma is indescribable and that all kinds of descriptions, metaphors, and comparisons for it are no more than temporary expedients. All comparisons have their limitations. If the Dharma is compared to emptiness, though emptiness is boundless, it cannot bring forth all things. Emptiness is an aspect of the Dharma. The other side, of course, is form. If the Dharma is compared to the earth, though the earth can bring forth things, it has boundaries. If it is compared to water, though water can flow through things, it can dry up. If it is compared to the wind, though the wind can move the myriad things, it can die down. If it is compared to fire, though fire light can banish the darkness, it cannot be touched. If it is compared to a tree, though a tree can produce all kinds of flowers and fruits, detached from the ground, it has no place to put its roots. If the Dharma is compared to a lotus, though the lotus has flowers and fruits at the same time, apart from water, it cannot exist. If it is compared to the kampa flower, though the kampa is fragrant, when the autumn wind comes, the fragrance disappears. If it is compared to jewels, though they are the most singular gems in the world, they do not equal the clear emptiness and pervading luminescence of the Dharma. The Dharma has been likened to a dragon, to a lion, to a great man, to a king, to a father, to a mother. It has been described as great, as small, as long, as broad, as square, as round, as curved, as straight. It has been compared to motion, to stillness, to curling up, to extending out, to the relative, to the absolute. In essence, despite the hundreds and thousands of metaphors, the Dharma is indescribable. Therefore, I say that descriptions, metaphors, and comparisons are nothing but the temporary expedient methods of the sages as they have responded to beings. For this reason, those who cling to the metaphors are stumped by the Dharma. They do not know the Dharma. This phrase, that these metaphors and so forth are nothing but the temporary expedient methods of the sages as they have responded to beings. Well, most of you know what he's talking about is just a skillful way of helping any particular questioner or student relate somehow to this truth, this Dharma that's beyond form, beyond words. It's another expedient means is a Buddha figure. Master Hakuin said, Buddhas in truth, Buddhas have no form. But they are given form out of human necessity. it's a recognition of what people need. And so someone a long time ago came up with the idea of presenting this Buddha nature in this particular form that we know as Buddha figures. Otherwise, most people would find it very hard to relate to the ultimate principle. The danger is getting attached to the image, to the word, the metaphor, whatever it is. And that's why Zibo here is going to some lengths here to help us not get attached to it. And this talk itself is another skillful means, another expedient means. In this next entry, Zibo says, "When the light of the eyes shines on objects, at first there is no hate or love. It does not shine on sandalwood any more than shit. This is called the everywhere equal light." Here he's talking about this original mind, this original vision that we have before the mind has been divided into categories of judgments and notions of good and bad and so forth. It's the mind of a newborn. It's the somewhat the mind of a dog that doesn't distinguish. But then it's more than that, because it is the mind of a human being. This is the mind of equality. But he goes on, "For the Buddhas and ancestral teachers, through joy and anger, through sadness and happiness, there is nowhere they go that is not this fundamental, everywhere equal light. For ordinary people, amidst the clouds of affliction, it may show through for a time, but the force of habitual behavior is strong, and it is immediately covered over again." So, people can get a little fleeting experience of this kind of seeing in Sesshin, or whenever we're doing a lot of Zazen. We can have moments where we see everything as fundamentally equal. This is the view from the absolute perspective, the essential perspective. From this side of things, everyone is equally endowed with this Buddha nature. It takes awakening to access this way of seeing. And that's why there is it's really indispensable, or it should be indispensable, for a teacher to have had some degree of awakening in order to the person of understanding will see every single person in Doksan as equally Buddha, equally enlightened in their fundamental nature. Yes, differences, of course. Each one, each student, completely unique. But within the differences, or kind of underneath the differences, is this marvelous sameness. Thus, those who are good at progressing on the path are able, when this light appears for a moment amidst hard-to-control junctures of good and evil, to set their eyes on it and see into it. They are not turned around by habitual behaviors. These are called brave heroes. If the energy falters, the clouds of ignorance abruptly close in. If the energy falters, that is, if we give way to thoughts, it takes energy to keep the mind present right here and not drifting into the future or into the past, into fantasy states. This need for energy becomes more obvious as when we're doing lots of sitting, as we are in Sesshin, come to see that this is demanding work to keep the mind on just this practice we're doing. Because of the force of habit, our conditioning is to give way to thoughts and be carried here and there. It's a strong force, and practice has been compared to swimming upstream against the current of habitual consciousness. It takes energy to swim upstream. It takes energy to hold to the practice. And it takes energy, when we've caught ourselves with the mind having wandered, to just return immediately to the practice. But the good news is that the more we do this, every time we redirect our mind back to the practice, we are acquiring energy. We're developing energy. There's a process of cumulative building of energy. So we have, as Sesshin goes on, we have more and more energy available to us to do this demanding work. Here's a short one. A monk asked, when Lin Qi returned from seeing Da Yu, how did Huang Bo know that he had penetrated the great affair? Now, this is a reference to the awakening of Lin Qi, Rinzai. He had been given a rough going over by his master Huang Bo. Physically, Huang Bo had given him some rough treatment, and he finally, in discouragement, he left and he went to this other teacher, Da Yu, and Da Yu helped him come to awakening. Huang Bo had sort of tenderized him, softened him up, and then he went to Da Yu, and Da Yu, through some skillful words, had helped Lin Qi come to awakening, and then Lin Qi went back to Wangbo. And that's what this monk is asking about. When Lin Qi returned from seeing Dayu, how did Wangbo know that he had penetrated the great affair? Wangbo apparently had seen at a glance that this was a different Lin Qi who had come back than the one who had left. And here's the answer. Zibo said, when those who are cold get a drink of wine, it becomes spring on their faces. When the hungry get food, their spirits radiate joy. How much the more so for one drunk on the supreme elixir. This one is called Causal Conditions for Enlightenment. The poor long for wealth. The wealthy long for noble rank. The nobility long for security and ease. Those secure and at ease long for immortality. Little do they realize that from longing comes having birth. From birth comes riches and nobility, poverty and low station, security and ease, and also all forms of existence and suffering continuing inexhaustibly. Therefore, if you want to cross the sea of suffering, you must take the boat of having no longings. Only then can you climb up onto that other shore. Now, speaking of metaphors, this is one of the original ones in Buddhism is crossing to the other shore of enlightenment from our own shore of delusion. So he's just stating what the nature of human beings, that we all want something more no matter what we acquire. We want something beyond that, and then something more, and then something more. And Zibo here is just stepping back and saying, hold it, hold it. When will we ever have real peace of mind, satisfaction? So long as this habit of desire, of craving, has the better of us. This is basic Buddhist doctrine, that it is our very habit of wanting, of grasping, of wanting to become something else. This is the engine of the wheel of life and death, the wheel of suffering. I learned long ago that when people hear things like this, some people get nervous and they say, how can you not have desires? Naturally, we have an inbred desire for food and for drink and sleep and sex maybe. But it's not really the problem. It's, as we said a couple of days ago in Taisho, it's our attachment to our desires, our inability to see them as impermanent, as something that'll just pass if we just give them half a chance. We don't have to act on our desires, except the most basic ones, of eating, for example. We do have something to say about the cravings that may come over us. And every time we give way to these, then we are just strengthening this habit of that keeps us revolving and through the wheel of samsara. But then he goes on, but longing cannot nullify itself. In order to nullify longing, or craving, we could say, or desire, you must hear the path, the Dharma. The path cannot be heard by itself. Here too, you must depend on causal conditions to draw you to it. Then it will be heard. Causal conditions are truly the mother of all the Buddhas, the teachers who sustain sentient beings. So, some examples for Siddhartha Gautama, one of the causal conditions that brought him to enlightenment, early, one of the early ones, was encountering these four sights, these sickness, old age, death, and then also seeing a monk. This was the tipping point in his life where he first saw the promise of something, the last one, the monk, and before that, where he first had to face these basic conditions of human existence. These are hugely important things for the Buddha to be, to see. I have endless fascination with the stories of our Sangha members, everyone here, as to what kind of causal conditions, what forces, what events led you in this usually a kind of a zigzaggy way to come to the Dharma. This is why when someone formally becomes my student in a ceremony, I always invite them to write up a brief autobiographical sketch, because it really is quite marvelous to see the many different ways, the little chance occurrences, the friends or family or seemingly mysterious events that can turn us in ways that eventually lead us to this teaching. One that springs to mind, there's so many, is one of our members from long ago who was in a restroom at a university, and there was some scrap of paper on the floor that had the notice about Roshi Philip Kaplow giving an introductory talk at the university. He hadn't heard anything about it, and he wandered into this talk and spent years practicing here. This is why I want to sometimes invite various Sangha members to go before the Sangha and present what we call a coming to the path story of their own personal journey and what landed them here. Look at Roshi Kaplow himself. Starting at the Nuremberg trials and having his smug atheism torn apart, hearing about all of these horrible events, 4 months, sitting there for 4 months of testimony, with Goering, Himmler, all these guys right there. You see it in a documentary on the Nuremberg trials. You see him there scribbling furiously with these guys up on the witness stand or the defendant's box next to him. And that just having split him open. Before that, he'd been just this reliance on the intellect, the rational mind, and how could he come to terms with this? And then, okay, that softened him up, that tenderized him, but then it took another experience of being at the Tokyo war crimes trials, and then by chance, having heard that the gardens at the Zen temples are quite beautiful, and he had a day off, there was another causal condition. He had a day off. And he found his way to that temple. And he walked through that garden, and even though he met no one, something stirred in him. Something he hadn't expected. He didn't even know what it was. He just knew that he was intrigued. What is this word, Zen? What is it anyway? And then coming back and finding this D.T. Suzuki and auditing classes at Columbia University with Suzuki, and then the rest is history. Even then, he told me he didn't know through these courses with D.T. Suzuki, he didn't know that you had to do Zazen to come to awakening. Suzuki, he said, never mentioned it. Never mentioned the work required. But Kaplow knew that this was for him, this enlightenment thing, and so he sold everything and went off to Japan, and what a surprise that was when he got to the Zendo and was told to sit. He said he thought that somehow he would get there, he would have sip sake with the masters, and somehow there'd be this magical kind of osmosis where he'd come to awakening. Zeebo continues here, taking marks of goodness as the causal basis means, for example, seeing the countenance of a virtuous person and having one's meanness and pettiness spontaneously dissolve. This was a big thing for me. It's just meeting Roshi at a workshop. Everything became clear at that point. Taking sound as the causal basis means, for example, the mind ground opening through under the impact of a single word. There are many accounts of enlightenment triggered by a chance sound, one where the monk is sweeping with a broom in the garden, and he happens to inadvertently flick a pebble that flew in the air and struck a tile, the tile of a temple roof, cock, and at that moment came to awakening. Other things, too, can be taken as the causal basis. The teachings of the sages, great enlightened teachers, good friends, and Dharma companions. You know, we've had plenty of people come here just because they have an acquaintance who gets into it, and then they find their way here. Adverse situations. that was mine, of landing in jail and being split open that way. Favorable situations. But according to Buddhist teaching, there has to be an affinity with the Dharma for these things to work. We have 50 people at every workshop who come, and 40 of them we don't see again. They have it all laid out right there, the Dharma. Basic principles of it, they get good instruction in it. But if without the affinity, if it's not the time for them, then it won't stick. For some of those people, we don't see them for a few years, then they come back, and maybe this time, maybe because they're ready, then they stay. We're told that even in the time of the Buddha himself, that were those who met him. There are plenty of stories about those who meet him and fall to their knees in awe of his person. But then there are others who, in the texts say, just said, "Well, whatever, So it has to be. This is also points to this wonderful, profound aspect of Buddhist doctrine, the law of dependent co-arising. It's not enough to have even a Buddha before us without our own readiness. There's this metaphor, another metaphor in the old texts about how rare it is to encounter the Dharma, and the analogy is it's as rare as it would be for a deep sea tortoise that comes up to the surface of the ocean only once a year. For that deep sea tortoise to come up and just by chance happen to emerge from the water in a wooden yoke that happened to be floating on the surface of the ocean. Those are the odds of our encountering this teaching, this practice. And having encountered it, how can we not use every minute we possibly can to come to liberation? The other side of this is we don't know how many more lifetimes, how many more thousands or millions of lifetimes it'll be after this one that we come into contact with this pristine Dharma. What is so marvelous about this Dharma, for one thing, is just that it gives us the means to change. What could be more wonderful? To evolve. I mentioned a couple days ago about people who have addictive personalities, say, and how easily it is to get lost in drugs and alcohol and all kinds of other things. What such people are longing for, of course, is samadhi, losing themselves, getting into finding self-transcendence, and that it's so poignant that with that underneath that behavior, that pain-producing behavior, is that the same longing that if would be turned to the Dharma could completely lift them out of that kind of behavior. Here's another one. With one mind unborn, being and nothingness are not in opposition, much less is there a perceiver. Here again, it's another way of expressing this realm that exists before consciousness stirs, before the discriminating mind divides the world into this and that. Being and nothingness are not in opposition. Even so, once one mind is born, the six sense faculties are already provided. It is not possible to have entry into enlightenment by abandoning these. In other words, we need our body-mind complex that gives us these five ordinary senses and the thinking mind. We need this we can't abandon these. How could we anyway? Therefore, when the perfected people expound the teaching, they may explain it with the tongue so that it can be entered via the ears, or they may explain it with the body so that it can be entered via the eye. Using these and all the sense faculties according to the surroundings, they open up its subtlety without constant pattern. They take in its marvel. You know, this is not the most felicitous translation. Well, maybe it is. Who knows? Maybe this is the best anyone could do with the original material in Chinese. But it's a little bit unwieldy at times. But let me go on. This being so, all things are the marks of the Tathagata's long, broad tongue. And here we have a footnote. The Tathagata's long, broad tongue, originally one of the 32 auspicious marks of the Buddha, this came to be taken in a broader sense as symbolic of the universality and infinite multiformity of the teaching of enlightenment. The universality and infinitely many ways of the teaching of enlightenment. And then he thankfully gets more specific here. All things are the marks of the Tathagata's long broad tongue. Sad songs, deep feelings, swearing and chiding, thorn forests and trees of beauty, gowns and caps, rites and music, drums and flutes, drinking, eating, sex, right and wrong, good and evil, the clash of weapons, the formal dance, silent misty forests, noisy urban squares. Whether one has entry or does not depends on how one hears Buddha's tongue in all these forms. To put it another way, everything is teaching in its own way. Everything is expressing this Dharma. Everything. The movement of the sun, the activity of animals outside, the falling of snow. everything is expressing it. Everything is it. Everything is a manifestation of this. How could it not be? What could be outside the Dharma? It's like, oh, okay, the Dharma is everything except maggots. Or those tent caterpillars in trees you see sometimes. This is what Umon was teaching when he was asked, what is Buddha? And he said, a dried piece of turd. What kind of a teaching would this be if it were just some things but not other things, or even most things but not other things, not the icky things? Or if it were just some people and not other people. A clash of weapons. People can bring to practice these notions of what it is and what it isn't. And this would fly in the face of any kind of attachment they have to the Dharma equaling peace. The Dharma is peace. No, the clash of weapons. The firing of drones. Another one is this idea that you hear about now and then, that Buddha nature, the people in their Buddha nature are basically good. Well, it's to say that limits it. People are what they are. That's its Buddha nature. Otherwise, ultimately, we're trying to shed notions. That's one way we can sum up Zen practice, is sloughing off notions about it. So that we can live it, we can be it. So long as we have ideas about it, this Dharma, this truth, enlightenment itself, then that's those ideas stand in the way of harmonizing with it. And so we have this practice of emptying the mind. Freeing ourselves of all of these notions. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.